Thank you. Okay, any questions? No, I'm...
This is Kimberly Clark Sharp, for those of you...
Three guesses who the speaker is. Let's see. Is it Craig Miller?
So we compliment Craig on the laser version, and we welcome Kimberly.
Well, how about if I reintroduce myself? By the way, formality is not on the agenda. I have to go back to something that you said, Bill, because I do go way back in the Wayback Machine in the International Association for Near-Death Studies, so far back that I remember when they coined the organization International Association for Near-Death Studies, the acronym being IONS. Lord help us. Before then, the name of the association was the Association for the Scientific Study of Near-Death Phenomena. So the acronym would have been ASNIPT. And you'd be Salt Lake City ASNIPT. So, hey, aren't we glad that got changed? We're not in church, so I'm going to say that word that I just did. We all have one, and you're sitting on it. And then the whole thing of groups, yeah, that actually sprang out of a conversation I had with one of the founders of IONS, because there wasn't anything for experiencers or people who had had a similar experience. There was just research out of the University of Connecticut. So Dr. Kenneth Ring, one of the researchers, happened to be in Seattle, and he told me his marriage was in big trouble because these near-death experiencers kept dropping by, to the point where he and his wife were calling their home the near-death hotel. And she was tired of it. So I said, I'm a social worker, a master of social work, licensed clinical social worker in the state of Washington. So a social worker never saw a problem that couldn't be solved with a group. I mean, it's like if two or more are gathered, well, you got a group. Yeah, so that's how groups got started. It was a conversation to save Ken Ring's marriage. We were sitting in a bar. We're on bar stools. We're drinking, but that was kind of like where I had dinner tonight at Olive Garden. We ate in the bar, and it was a similar situation. So I started a group. There were four of us. May I have one of my books? I'm very poor at promoting this book. We had this conversation coming in. I do have something to say about it. One is the three other people that were Seattle IONS, their near-death experiences are in here, and they are absolutely beautiful. One is a native Alaskan woman who hemorrhaged in childbirth, found herself, if you've been to Alaska, there's a lot of forests. And she found herself on a forest path, towering trees, got to a chasm. She said it wasn't very wide, but it was impossibly deep. And on the other side were her deceased family members, going back to ancestors. But right across from her was her deceased sister holding an infant. And for lack of better words, she was simply given to know that that was the child that she had been bearing, and that that child had died. The baby was dead. She also knew that the baby was appearing in infant form for recognition purposes, but that in real spiritual life, there wasn't squalling infant. That was the physical form back. I really invite you to read her story. Also, she got pretty ticked off because as far as she could see were ancestors, and they were all saying, go back. And for near-death experience, them's fighting words, because, you know, it were like back home, then getting kicked out again. That's her story. Another woman was a burn patient. He had terrible scars right up to here. Had been an atheist scientist, and so her testimony is in here. And then good old Betty Preston, deceased. Another incredible near-death experience in that she was having heart surgery at the University of Washington Medical Center, and her heart began to expand in air. So the surgeon had two choices. Watch Betty's heart go to bits all over the operating room suite, or take a scalpel and stab her in the heart. Now that's death, ladies and gentlemen. That is really seriously ill. Her near-death experience is in there, but one part of it I want to share is that she was in a tunnel with animals. Actually, if she were here, she would correct me, with animals loved by people. There were birdies and horses and dogs and cats and all kinds of critters. When I first heard her story, I thought, in shame of all of the goldfish I'd flushed down the toilet growing up, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be met with this, you know. You killed me! My life review will have fins and the occasional shell. Remember those dime turtles? How many people have gray in their hair? Come on, show of head. Yeah, we used to get them. They cost a dime. I'm from Kansas. That's what they cost, a little plastic island with a palm tree. Yeah, I'll be meeting those. But anyway, Betty had no affinity towards animals. The skeptics say, these people get what they expect. No, I have yet to actually encounter that person. Betty, though, never had a pet in her life. And so now she's with this tunnel. She thought she was in the wrong place. And maybe she was. She had wonderful, fabulous adventures and heard her son praying and was begging her through prayer, silent prayer, but she heard it in heaven. And it drew her back because she loved her son. So this and a kajillion other stories are in here, but I'll start with mine. So how did I get to Salt Lake City? I died. And I'm talking about 1970 when I was in Salt Lake City. I have something to say about being here. But before then, I was in Kansas. I was being raised kind of Lutheran. My parents would kick us to the curb in front of the church for Sunday school and go have coffee and then pick, oh, you're a Lutheran. That's how we Lutherans roll. And there has to be coffee. Sorry, there has to be coffee. When I go home to Kansas, my mom is still there and siblings, and coffee-wise, they have Folgers and Folgers Premium, so they're like, most excellent. That's why there's been a Starbucks at the airport for people like me getting off the plane headed into Salt Lake City where, you know, there's not a Starbucks on every corner like in Seattle. Oh yeah, dead. So I grew up in the greater Kansas City area in a place called Johnson County. So I grew up with money. My dad was the senior partner in the law firm that represented every tobacco company in the United States and Canada, the original insider. Great dad, good lawyer, obviously. Everyone's still smoking cigarettes. Well, not right here, but you know, the tobacco industry is thriving with other lawyers. But I grew up wanting nothing. To quote myself in the book, see a pony, get a pony. Nothing was denied me, but I also wrote about our home as being, it's like checking into a very nice hotel. You know, everyone was very nice, but not very close particularly. And there wasn't a big spot for God in there. I had enough privilege where I didn't need to drive many places, but come the day, I decided I wanted to drive and I wanted a car. So on May 25th, 1970, beautiful Saturday morning, my dad took me to the Johnson County, now I can drop these place names, Department of Motor Vehicles. And I don't remember that day at all. So I'm going to tell you my dad's memory, and then I'll tell you my memory. I guess this side of the room here is my dad's memory, and then I turn. We'll leave and discuss it. All of this without them, okay. My dad, this is his story. I remember turning to my dad and saying something like it felt bad or poorly, and I wanted to sit down, and he said there weren't any chairs, and I have no more memory for, I don't know when my memory picked up, gradually came back. According to my dad, we were waiting for my number to come up, which I think is, you know, ironic, right? Well, let's face it, it's ironic to have a near-death experience in the Department of Motor Vehicles. I don't care where you live. I mean, yeah, one look at my license photo would kill you. So the whole thing, you know, bureaucratic NDE happens in Kansas. I then signed the papers appropriately, and we were headed out. As we got to the door, my dad noticed that my complexion was white on white. Then I fell into and through his arms. I was literally dead weight. And dead weight is heavier than live weight. There's just no resistance. Not having caught a lot of dead bodies in my life, but, you know, he couldn't hold my weight and I wasn't very big. There happened to be a uniformed nurse passing by. She trotted over, determined that I wasn't breathing and I didn't have a pulse. Back then, two phone calls were made. One to the Johnson County volunteer firefighters were called, and an ambulance from St. Luke's Hospital, if you know Kansas City area. It was the largest facility that close to my body. The fire department came first. Bert, this is not a good story. Close your ears. We have a retired fire chief here. they had a brand new ventilator. Do you remember the Anderson ventilator? Did you ever play with that? Yeah. Well, anyway, it was it was a very cool ventilator because it would ventilate, which is what you want. But also, at the flick of a switch, it had a vacuum mode, which was useful because a lot of people die because objects are blocking the throat. So you can push all the air in you want, but if there's not an open airway, it's not going to help you. This is also called cafe coronary. If you're, we just came from Olive Garden, so I'm the one who inhaled the salad. You know, sometimes people get like lettuce and such caught in their throats. And you know what? 7 years ago in Chicago, I did CPR on such an occasion. A woman in the place where we were dining choked on her food and lost consciousness and stopped breathing. And she's alive. So learn CPR. Really, it'll be someone you probably know, not a stranger in a restaurant, but nonetheless, it's a good idea. So they came with this new ventilator. According to my father, it was new packaging. Ripped it open, put the seal on my face, which is, you know, what we all want. Turned it on, and it was on vacuum mode. Yeah, they hadn't practiced with it. So I had the life sucked out of me. Remind me to quote myself again later, okay? Because that's one I haven't used before. Yeah, it sucked the life out of me. Well, it became immediately apparent what had happened. And I'm going to come upstairs so I can see you all in the back row. I feel like you're in Nevada or California. I can't tell what direction, but...
Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, okay. I'll bet you can't see me either. That's a Las Vegas joke. Come forward if you want more animation, because I know you're there. That's my phone. Who didn't turn off her cell phone? And it's from 800-000-000. I'm saying God calling. Oh, I missed the call. Well, there goes my mission trip. Anyway, I should turn it off, I guess. That's not a phone number. That's kind of weird. You paid good money to hear this talk, I understand. No, we charge the same in Seattle as here, which is nothing. So, oh yeah, dead on the sidewalk. Firefighters knew immediately something was terribly wrong because, you know, I turned blackish around my face and my extremities. So they flicked a switch, started pumping air in. Are there any intensive care unit nurses or physicians here? Or any healthcare personnel at all? Hi. Well, there's something called, we'll get to it. The air had nowhere to go. Because all of this air had been drawn out, my lungs had come in contact with themselves. That's why I need a healthcare personnel. And our lungs are sticky things. So to be reopened, it's in an ICU situation under steady, even pressure. Well, that wasn't possible on the sidewalk. So they blasted this air into my body, and the air had to go somewhere, and it went to my skin. And I literally blew up like a flesh balloon. That's called epithelial emphysema. That is very hard to live through. So then they gave up. The firefighters, as Bert knows, a firefighter cannot say she's dead. But they did say to my dad, I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. At that point, someone my dad always called, the Good Samaritan, came back from now a really large crowd. I don't know what it's like in Utah, but in Kansas, if there's a girl dead on the sidewalk, it becomes street theater within 10 minutes. Edna, you gotta get on down to the DMV. There's a girl dead on the sidewalk. Hold it, I'll call. Well, anyway, that's how it went. My dad doesn't know where all these people came from except telephone calls. So from the back of this big crowd came a man of fierce strength. He just plucked everybody off in front of him and the firefighters. Now, we know he was not from Salt Lake City because my dad said he was swearing like a mule skinner. And I am sure no Mormon ever swore ever. So we're safe bet he was from, we'd like to say Missouri. So little Kansas rivalry joke. But anyway, apparently his language was just terrible. And he did what we now call citizen CPR. And then he turned to my dad and said, and I won't be saying this, but GD, you know, I'm not getting a blank, blank thing. And then my dad's memory ends. And at some point later, he remembers a great cheer coming up from now the audience, because my body was on the ambulance somewhere along the line. The ambulance had arrived. Off we went to the hospital. Things went sour in the emergency room. Picked back up. I hate to give away the end of a book, but she lived. But shh. It's the last page. No, it's not. I lived in the first chapter, because this book is called After the Light, not During the Light. It's what happened after. But first I'll tell you what happened to get me to the after. And there was a light. I first heard a woman's voice to my left saying, "I'm not getting a pulse, I'm not getting a pulse." And really with the same sense of reality with which I'm now speaking, I said to her, "Of course you're getting a pulse, otherwise I wouldn't be speaking." She ignored me. So I did, I think, again, what anyone would do. Eventually, I just thought, I don't know, maybe it was a near-death snit. I don't know. But I just thought, fine, I'm out of here. I was then in a different place. I was surrounded by warm, dense, foggy material. I knew I was someplace. I knew I wasn't alone. And I had emotion. I felt like I was comfortably waiting for something. Like I had a ticket on Southwest Airlines to fly from Seattle to Salt Lake City. I didn't know exactly where my seat would be, but I knew I was going to be on board. That was timeless, as is everything. There's two elements about a near-death experience that are very challenging. One is that there are no words. Everything you hear about someone's near-death experience are going to be metaphors. There's just not a language to encompass these events. And the other is that there's no time. So this warm, foggy place, because of timelessness, which is a universal element of a near-death experience, I can't say how long I was there. Approximately forever, or for a split second, I don't know. It didn't make any sense to me, but one thing I want to add parenthetically is that I learned later that in World War II, which so far is probably the greatest danger that the entire globe has been in ever, every country that was making movies at that time made movies about the afterlife. So Japan, India, Great Britain, America, Canada, it was on everyone's mind. That's not a big surprise. All of the movies I've seen from that era on that subject involved gray, foggy material. This is from different cultures. So I kind of think maybe there's a collective consciousness and we all go through this corridor and then some people make a U-turn. But that's just too many representations of the same thing from too many different countries. So I just thought that was interesting. Well, anyway, then in the midst of all this, God showed up. God showed up in the form of a bright light, which is so diminishing of that which I call God anyway. When I say bright light, there's nothing. The closest thing I've seen to it, and I watched it over and over and over and over, was when the meteor a short time ago landed over Russia, and the whole sky, there was dash cams in Russia. Are every car comes with a dash cam. So that's why there were so many images. If you haven't seen it, look it up, that big blast of light. I thought, whoa, that looks kind of familiar. Now multiply it times a jillion, million, quadrillion, whatever, to infinity, and that's how bright this light was. But I can't even say it was God, because I'm not God. It's the form that God chose to present God, though, in to me and to many, many other near-death experiencers. So it didn't hurt my eyes, but the funny thing is, what eyes? My eyes were on a sidewalk in Kansas. Yet I could see, and by golly, I could communicate. The communication was a form of math and music, which is a stitch, because I have skills in neither one. Seriously, don't. Don't you tell my husband, but I keep the checkbook in our house. This is just a confession. Don't you ever, he doesn't know it. I'm sitting here giving a talk about it. But anyway, I balance a checkbook. What I do is close our account and open it every January 2. And then I know how much money we have, and that's my accounting. So I can't add, subtract, anything. I don't do that. But he's worse. So this time of year, I'm doing pretty good. By Easter, I have a sense of, you know, how much we're going to be spending in the month of March and April. Come December, it's a good thing it's Christmas. I'm just writing checks. I have no idea where they're going and how much is in there. It's clueless. So that's my math skills. I come from a family where music was valued, and I had no skill at all. My piano teacher quit me when I was in the seventh grade. It was during Song of the Volga Boatman. Ba-da-ba-ba. He had these precociously musical sibs of mine, and he just said, I can't teach her. I'm still in there going, die, die, die. So what the heck? Math and music, but it was perfect. It was just perfect. I just don't have a way to describe it, except guess what? There's so much brain science going on. And in terms of human development, it seems that until around age 10, the brain doesn't even know the difference between math and music. So parents and grandparents, if you expose your child or grandchild to music before age 10, math skills come easier. And then around 10, you know, give or take, that window closes. And it becomes harder to learn both. It doesn't, I don't know. Just research it, look it up. I really don't know. I ask questions. I ask questions anyone would ask God, in the presence of God. To even say God is almost sacrilegious. It's three letters in the English language. You could say Carl. With a certain reverency, I'm not saying there was a name tag, but I knew it was God. In fact, I said, in the presence of this light, the first thing I quote-unquote said was, homie home. Later, I learned from my parents that homie home is what I used to say as a toddler when we were away from our neighborhood, and then we'd be pulling back into the block where we lived, and I would recognize certain landmarks. This is before seatbelts, so I'd stand up and go, homie home, homie home. I don't remember that, but I sure remember saying homie home in front of the Lord Almighty. And I was home. He was my creator. And that's what I'm most comfortable saying about God. That was my creator. I don't put a gender on it. It was genderless, and yet man and woman. But I have no way to translate this. But it was all love. And that's all that mattered to me. It was pure, unconditional love, which actually, if I had been in flesh upon receiving that kind of affection, I would have been blown to smithereens. I would have been like Betty Preston's heart in the surgical suite. I don't think I could have stood it. That's how much love God has for us. It's just, it's immeasurable and profound and beyond description. But anyway, I asked questions, again, in this math and music stuff. I asked why we were born, for instance. What the heck am I, what's the point? And I was told, not in English, but in this symbolic, perfect language, that we basically banged on the door to get in. We kicked it in. We wanted to be born. We wanted to be born there and there and now. And it was like we made these pretty precise decisions. I liken life, and this is not Mormon teaching. Again, I've established I'm a Lutheran. And oh, by the way, it's not Lutheran teaching either. But I think life's kind of like a Monopoly board, that there are certain things that we have agreed before we are born to experience, and then we hit the board and we're faced with everyone else's will, and what we get is life. So that's how I was given to understand why we were born. Our souls wanted it. This light itself, by the way, sprang forth underneath me, and again, no eyeballs, but I could see. It went in all directions, no matter where I turned. And at the same time, it was endlessly layering back on itself. And I had the awareness that I was beholding time, in a sense, and dimensions, that time was endless. We are eternal. This is a pit stop in something we can't comprehend, but we are eternal and desperately wanted this life. But that layering back and back and back, I think I was seeing dimensions, which were also unlimited. It's a big place out there. That's what I'm saying. It's not just, this lonely planet. It just was so infinite. It was amazing. Now I asked, what about pain and suffering? And not in those words. I don't think I was sophisticated enough, but it's like, why do people hurt? Something like that. It's like, well, and that's the way back to God. It's what brings us to be thinking about God, to impeaching God for things. It's a connection, and sadly, it's just the way it is. I then heard something no one would want to hear, and that's that I was being sent back. And that was awful. So I said no. And God said yes. And I said no. I was firstborn, by the way. Did I mention that? Willful like you wouldn't believe. Yeah, out of my way. In fact, my best friend still has, because I'm still firstborn, I will be my whole life, go figure. Here's my best friend imitating me in prayer. Thy will be done, thy will be done, thy will be done, my will be done, thy will be done, thy will be done. I mean, I just keep trying to edge it in there. Well, I'm here to tell you and absolutely bear witness to the fact that you can argue with God. I did. It's just that God's going to win. So you have to settle for that. The great creator seems to know a little bit more than I do, so go figure. So I was sent back. Well, when I took my driver's test, I flunked because I couldn't get within 4 feet of the curb parallel parking. I still can't, and I won't. I do not parallel park. No one in the car wants me to parallel park either. So we have consensus. I was sent back, and by golly, I missed my physical body by about 4 feet. It was a hoot. And here I'd had this most sacred experience, and all I could think of is, I can't park myself. So now what am I going to do? But then I saw this man, turned out to be the Good Samaritan, I guess. We never know what happened to him. I saw a man come over and bend over me, and the moment his mouth touched mine, I went back into my body, but through him. Now there's an interesting experience. And I knew everything about the guy, emotionally anyway. But what I realized is that what drew me to him, I'm sure the physical contact was a huge part of it, like a grounding. He loved me. It was compassion, which is a huge kind of love. He had compassion for me. It was wonderful. I had just been with the greatest love of all. And so, of course, it was like a lighthouse in a storm at sea. Of course I was drawn to it. And then I was back in my body. Well, then we get to after the light. How many people here have had a near-death experience or some kind of spiritually transformative experience where you know that life as you knew it? What's that? I've had half a near-death experience, so I'll just put... What's your name?
Dan.
Okay, here's a near-death experience for Dan. Thank you. It's too bad I'm so stiff and reserved in this group. I'm taking over, Bill. I'm moving to Salt Lake City, and I'm taking over because I love them. Now, I'm feeling so much love right now. I wish you were me. I'm not saying I'm in heaven, but it's a slice of it. Thank you for that. Ooh, it's really feels wonderful to be here. So anyway, I had changed. This had changed everything. So, oh, I forgot about coming back. I'm sorry. I got distracted by the arms in the air. And how'd I get back? Well, sure, I was back in my body, but guess what? Things got really bad after that because it was dark and cold and clammy and icky. And I had awareness, I had consciousness, but I felt like I was running around in this dead body. And maybe I'd watched a little too much Vincent Price, you know, who was very popular then. Like, I'm going to be buried alive. It was terrifying. And it was so cold. Actually, I pulled my medical records in writing after the light because I didn't want some journalist to do it first. I wanted to see what was written, which was interesting. You can't chart like this anymore, but right across the admitting sheet in the ER was primary diagnosis unknown because of the snafu with the ventilator. I thought, snafu, it killed me. It's like, taking me a little lightly. Oh, that's snafu. Oh, that one. But my admitting body temperature was 86. So we're getting to be cold. So no wonder I was cold. So I did, again, what anybody would do. I prayed. I asked God to come back. It wasn't a nice prayer. It was more of a screaming, whining mess. Like, God! God showed up, not in the form of a light, but in this math and music communication. You know, I begged to go home. This was hell. This was awful. I didn't want to be there. I didn't. I wanted to go home. So to my right, opened this window-like thing, and there, again, with skeptics, there was, it looked like Kentucky, a state I've yet to visit. But, you know, waving grass and low fences in the background, blue sky, foliage. I mean, it was beautiful. Just wasn't in colors associated with Earth. More like, they went to Italy a year ago last May. These are the cherries, by the way. I'm staying with them, and we had the Mother of All slideshows last night, and the water off of Capri I just didn't want to interrupt the slideshow. But anyway, there are places where colors aren't consistent with the rest of the globe. The colors that I saw were too intense for anything I've ever seen in any photo anywhere on Earth. And it was balmy, and it was my heaven, I guess. I have a grass heaven waiting for me. I don't know, but that's where I wanted to go. And I was just given to know that if I went through that, that was my boundary. Once through, not coming back. You sure you want this? Yes, I do. So I was like, out of there, Jackie Gleason style. And I was almost through the window when it was a popular TV show, again, for the gray hairs. Remember the show Columbo? God watched that show and loved it. I know, because God became Columbo. It was like I was almost all the way through, and all of a sudden there was this, just a minute. Just like Columbo would get to the very end and then turn and one more thing, and then would nail the bad guy. Well, it was one more thing for me. He goes, let me show you one more thing. And there was a flash and then an image, and the image showed where mountains met water. And I was also given to know that if I chose to live, because we have this free will thing, I believe you call it agency, but same idea. If I chose to live, that's where I would spend the rest of my life. Well, it wasn't Kansas. And I didn't care. I'm still going to heaven. And then there were more flashes, and there were people. And they had, like, readable tags, like best friend, next door neighbor, coworker, mentor. It kind of went on like that. They were complete strangers to me. I could care less. Again, I'm still traveling. And then it was like, oh, then came the big Columbo moment. And that was an image of me being of service. Well, until then, there were two kinds of service in my life. Sterling and what I got. The thought of giving service was like, blah, 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 blah. And I said something to the effect of cool, and I was back. Now, I don't call that a strong choice. I just was admiring the handiwork of the Lord. But that was considered a decision, and I was back. So now what? I have to find where mountains meet water. I have to live my destiny. I have memories. Now I have to live out my future memories. It's pretty crazy. But I bought a car, the Green Weenie. That's what I dubbed it, my Volkswagen Squareback. We were saying on the way here, I've had four cars in my whole life, and they all have names, and there's colors in the names. So the Green Weenie was the first. It was a stick shift. I didn't know a clue about driving a stick shift. I don't know what. But it was a cheaper car. Suddenly I cared about thinking about money that wasn't mine. I had a hamster named Toto. I kept him in a birdcage. Toto was in the front seat. I was happily driving. Well, not really happily. My family was in the driveway. We just reviewed pictures of this, by the way. But then a few months ago, I was in Kansas in October, and out came these photos. And my family, they did not let me go. I basically backed up over them like speed bumps to get out of there. They still don't understand why I'm not back home with them. But I was fearless because God had, you know, plan this life for me, and off we go. Well, God should have told me how to drive a stick shift, because I found reverse, and I found first and second. Third and fourth were a little dicey. So I'm driving along, and poor Toto's going, we're all gonna die. I mean, it's like, have you ever seen a hamster and a ball roll around, you know, just every now and then peep up with a look of terror? And as I approached I-70, the vein that runs between the coasts, the full weight of this decision. I'd never been away from home. I mean, what was I doing leaving? And I got really scared, and I began to cry. And Toto was terribly excited. Does this mean we're going back? No, it just means I'm going to cry. And if you watch Oprah Winfrey, she talks about the ugly cry. The ugly cry is when, you know, your canine teeth show, a lot of trembling down here where you don't need to draw attention. Mucus is involved. It was that kind of weeping. And I began to protest. I don't want to go. No, I want to go back. I don't want to change. I hate change, which I did, by the way. I was planning to marry Bob Clark. Known him since the seventh grade. My plan was, I marry Bob Clark. I don't have to change monograms on the towels. I'm still Kim Clark. I thought it was a great idea.
Bob Clark is in the photos of me backing up over my family, looking dreadfully confused as anyone. So we're approaching the toll booth, and I am now wailing to God, who isn't showing up, and saying, I don't want to change, I don't want to change, mucus, etc. And all of a sudden, God did show up, and in the form of the God that I have been with since that moment. Because in front of the toll booth, when I had to make a decision, am I going to go east or west? I'm screaming about, I don't want to change, I don't want to change. And there was a big sign that said, change needed. I beg your pardon? I took it personally. And then, of all things, I did have this mucus stuff going. I got the joke, okay, you know. But I needed to blow my nose, and Toto was having none of it. But I swear, I don't remember putting this between the seats. But I looked down, white box, black letters, Kimberly Clark. I'm actually in every bathroom in the world if you start looking. I married a Sharp, but by then I was so far into academics, and I at the University of Washington where I wound up, and had published so much that I didn't want to lose the credibility for all that I had published before I married. So I became Kimberly Clark Sharp. But otherwise, until, you know, I was 38 before I married, I waited a long time because my saying when I met guys was, I was sent back to serve mankind, not one man. Noble, huh? Until you fall in love with Donald Sharp and then it's all over. It's like, no, I want this man. Anyway, I went left and first landed in Denver, mountains, no water. And then my brother lived in Berthoud Pass in Colorado, so up I went, more mountains, still no water. And then I went down the hill to Salt Lake City. And so in 1970, summer of, I was here with the Green Weenie and Toto, and there were mountains and water. And I had an aunt who lived here who had become a Mormon, left the Lutheran Church. Oh, the scandal, they're still talking about it. My Aunt Sophie, our couch is named after her if you ever come to Seattle and visit us, big lumpy thing in the office. So she was in a wheelchair and we went to the copper mines. I never include this in a speech ever, ever, nor here. But is it still there, the big copper hole in the ground? She was in a wheelchair and I was getting kind of tired. She was a massive German woman holding her back. So she said, well, just sit on my lap. Two of us had a near-death experience, and all the people that we, it was insane. But anyway, she said, honey, you've had yourself a spiritual experience. And that's where I got that word. And she thought I could go on, and then became Lake Tahoe. See, we could have met then. And it was, remember the Righteous Brothers? You never hold. It was Bill of the Righteous Brothers. I met him there. He said, no, I think you should keep going. Well, then came San Francisco. By then, I was a hippie. I had changed completely from Kansas. And that was some kind of mountains and water, but it wasn't so. And again, I've been told to refer people for more information to read After the Light. Things happened in San Francisco. The hippie culture was perfect for me, though. I'm not going to regret any of it. Peace, love, drugs, no war, all of, you know, love everybody. That was good for a near-death experiencer. It was in alignment with, let's all love one another. But God didn't have that in my future. So away I went up to Seattle. When I crossed the city line, I thought, what have I done? Or what have I been sent to do? Talk about a mission. Big old sign that said, will the last person leaving Seattle please turn out the lights? It was like the Boeing bust. There were no jobs. PhDs lined up for janitorial work. And I'm driving into town with Toto going, God sent me. But you know what? God did. Everything I've done since then has been like stepping on the automatic door opener at the grocery store. If I'm meant to go in, there's work beyond. I got to stock the shelves. I got to sell this stuff. The lights never go out. We're open 24/7. But to get where I'm supposed to be has been no effort. Always in the right place at the right time. Went into the field of death and dying, became an assistant professor, blah, 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 wrote up things, started a group. But here was my dirty little secret. My dirty little secret is that I thought I was schizophrenic. Because in those days, there was nothing, no coinage of a phrase called near-death experience, no map, no menu, no nothing. But in the School of Social Work, I learned about schizophrenia, and I thought, I'm a highly functioning schizophrenic.
And that explains it all. Now, the last thing I heard, sort of like a voiceover, heading back finally from my near-death experience, was a voice that said, I would forget everything except as it would be manifest. Well, it turns out manifest meant working with dying people and their loved ones. Every time I was with a dying person, which was a lot because I worked on intensive care at a trauma center that still serves 1/4 of the landmass of the United States and Canada, I was in the heart of death and dying and loving it. Oh, was I good at what I did? Well, I'd been dead, silly, but I had switched from God to a mental health crisis and really sealed the deal once when I saw a woman who looked a lot like me, and she was in the emergency room in 2-point restraints, sitting on a gurney with her arms held down like this, looking miserable. And I said offhand, oh, what's her deal? And the intern said, oh, she's been going in and out of her body, so we're taking her up to a 5th floor, which is psychiatric lockup. And I thought, okay, that does it. I'm never, ever, 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 ever going to share this. But then along came a woman named Maria. It was April 1977. Maria changed my life. She'll change yours. Hispanic woman, working in Eastern Washington, had come to Seattle for the first time. Big city, big lights. Oops, big heart attack. So she was brought into Harborview Medical Center, where I was working, and had been successfully resuscitated because she spoke only Spanish with un poco inglés. We needed a translator, and so the social worker does that and find the family and try to find some money. And anyway, so the first few days that she was in the hospital, I spent a lot of time with her doing my job. And then once I was doing my charting in a room where with the nurses where the monitors we're all gathered, and all of a sudden, flatline, somebody. Well, that happened like hourly. It wasn't that big of a deal. But it was Maria. I thought, aw. So I walked down to the room, and in a university hospital, if you haven't had the honor and privilege of being in one, it's good hospitals, but you don't get a doctor, a nurse, and a respiratory therapist. You get the thundering herds. You get the attending, the residents, the interns, heck, the dietitians show up. I mean, everybody comes when there's, it's called a code. So I watched Maria being resuscitated pretty easy by resuscitation standards. I left, she was unconscious, breathing on her own, fine. Towards the end of the day, I was paged back up to the unit because Maria was awake and so agitated, they were afraid that she was gonna flip right back into cardiac arrest. No one knew why she was agitated. No one could find the translator. So I got kicked into the room because I'm the social worker. Any social workers here by any chance? Ah, you know the drill. Hi, hi, babies. Yeah, so scut work it's called. You know, go fix it. So off I go. I had some Spanish, I think, for like 3 minutes in high school. So why me? So I'll condense a long conversation. She said that during her resuscitation, she found herself in a corner of the room. She pointed it out. She told me who was in the room, about the equipment. It was all correct. I didn't believe her because I thought, well, to the best of our knowledge, hearing is the last sense to go. She heard voices. She knew who was on duty. She had been well schooled by the nurses as to what equipment would be available if she needed it. Fine. So I discounted it. And then she said like that, she was out of her body and looking over the emergency room entrance and the one-way driveway. And I thought, yeah, yeah, lady. Well, I wasn't that careless, but well, your room's above the emergency room. So probably somebody from housekeeping or whatever had pushed her bed to the window. Maybe, I didn't think she was lying, but maybe she just didn't remember it. As if someone from housekeeping was going to disconnect somebody that was that sick. You know, like, hold your breath. I'm going to be cleaning the stain real good here. And you just sit by the window and die. No, but I was ruling that out. And then she said she was distracted by something, and it was a tennis shoe. It was on a different side of the building. She thought she was 3 or 4 stories above the ground. It was a dark blue tennis shoe. Should I get confused by any other tennis shoes out there? There was a lace under the heel and the little toe was scuffed up. And the reason she was agitated is that she was excited and she wanted someone to get the shoe. Again, fell to the social worker. So I had the luck, oh, the Kim. I started out on the wrong side of the building. First I started out outside and on the wrong side of the building, but then I saw a bird fly and then I couldn't see the bird because the bird landed on a ledge and I realized I can't see the ledge. Anyway, to make a longer story shorter, I finally, on the 3rd floor, walked into a room facing west and
I had to go. There were things in some rooms that were blocking the windows. So in some cases, and this one too, I had to go all the way in and look down. And then there was the shoe on the ledge. It was like my world spun. It was my watershed moment. In moments of that importance, you remember little details? I remember not being able to support my body weight. It was like a flour sack had hit me behind the knees. And I went bonk, my forehead hit the glass. And out loud I said, "This happened to me." And I remember the fogginess of my breath against the pain for a moment, and then it's settling down. So if you hear any other version of the story, that's the truth. This is a shoe heard around the world, a red shoe. No, it was a blue shoe. One best-selling author had me crawling out on the ledge and then on my hands and knees. Now, I wore mini skirts back then, pardon my best side, but yeah, as if I'm going to crawl. And then I turned a corner and crawled and got the shoe and then backed up. You know, didn't get arrested. I mean, come on. I opened the window and I picked up the shoe. I thought it was pretty dramatic as it was. So if you ever hear that I was outside on a ledge, I am not Lucille Ball. Close. Close, as my host. But I'm not fully there. I won't go out on your ledge. Anyway, I had the shoe, and then it was like, Viva Zapata, that shoe. Back then, I know this is extraordinary, but ladies and gentlemen, back then if you were sick, you actually stayed in the hospital until you were well. I know it's radical, but there she was for 3 weeks, and the shoe, everybody saw the shoe. It was highly witnessed. So no skeptic's been able to nail this one. And there she was, again, without eyeballs, spotting an object. So that's when I realized this did happen to me too. And if there were two of us, there had to be more. And I began to ask questions that I asked to this day of people. What happened that led up to your death, or close to it? And what happened during it, and how's it changed your life? I would ask, what do you remember? And until June, it was nothing. Got hit by the car, but nothing. And then in June, I met a 16-year-old who was there for an overdose because of a boy, suicide attempt, and a teenager. And here I'd gotten blank stares for 2.5 months. And then all of a sudden, she's looking up at me going, "Oh, I saw my oompa." She might as well have been smacking gum. She was so, you know, whereas Maria was so agitated about it all. This gal, in the book, I call her Penny. There are two names in the book that are disguised by a couple of letters, because otherwise everybody's story that I tell, they have literally signed off paperwork, because I wanted them to be fairly represented. So those two people I never have found, but her real name is Patty. Anyway, she was with her oompa, and I didn't know that musical instrument. It's like, what's an oompa? Well, oompa turned out to be her grandpa, who had died when she was about 2, and she couldn't say grandpa. Here she was, a suicide attempter, yet she was swept into Oompa's arms as if she were still a toddler and put on his lap, then kind of scolded, "You got to go back there and face the music. No boy is worth it." Things a grandpa, an Oompa, would say to a teenage girl. She did recover, and for the longest time, I trotted her out like a show pony to area high schoolers, because nothing like another kid telling a kid don't hurt yourself, especially over romance with someone whose name you're not going to remember in 10 or 15 years. So on it went. I just began to meet more and more people, and then started the group. In 1995, one of my graduate students did an actual count of all the people I'd interviewed, eyeball to eyeball, nose to nose, so no phone calls, no letters or emails or anything. Anyway, it was 2000, so I haven't counted since. So I have, you were right about the number of people, Bill, that I've spoken to. It just, yeah, they just keep rolling in. So I needed a bra last Friday, and I'm in the store, and I don't know how the subject came up. It's just what God provides. But it turns out my fitter had 2 near-death experiencers. And talk about falling out of yourself. I was like, what? They're everywhere. They're everywhere. And I would love if I could interrupt everything and tell you my favorite angel story. A woman died. We had curtains in the intensive care unit that would be pulled. People weren't in separate rooms. Big ward. And a woman died, and she had a teenage son, also 16, come to think of it. Maybe that's why it's coming to mind. He was in the waiting room all by himself and traumatized beyond measure, of course. He didn't want to see his mom, but he wanted to say goodbye. I said, no big deal.
I explained the setup in there, and I drew the curtain, and then came out and got him and took him to the side of her body. He didn't have to see her, although she didn't look bad, didn't want to see her, fine. And I said, talk to her. I know she can hear you. Tell her whatever you want her to know. And I walked away. What he didn't know is that I could see her, and she was standing next to him with her arm around him as he spoke to her body. It was amazing. It was amazing. Again, love carries the day. Sandy Cherry's favorite angel story, or one of them anyway, has to do with the motorcycle. So back before the Twilight series was written, Forks in La Push, Washington, if you're not into vampires, you have no idea what I'm talking about. And why would I think you're into vampires? I'm in an Ions meeting, but some of us are. I had been dating a fellow. By now, I was maybe out of Harborview, and I founded the Department of Social Work at the world's first bone marrow transplant unit. So now I'm, you know, seeing oncologists, and I'm still not serving a man, I'm serving mankind. So this was an oncologist I worked with, but he had his own plane. Fun to date him. We had flown from Seattle over to the peninsula and gotten caught in a terrible storm after we landed. So he left me in La Push, this little town that's in the Twilight series books, and off he went. But this was in my early days of like angel vision and dead people vision and demonic visions. And I don't want to say demon. I want to call it negative energy because it takes many forms, not just, you know, blah, like the devil. No, it takes many forms, more than love, actually. Anyway, I was scared, and it was a terrible storm, and he was going to go off and check on the plane, small private plane. And he always packed this small bike, like a scooter, like a Vespa kind of thing. So off he went, and I'm watching him go off into the storm, and it was like a cartoon, because around him, as if a person, was this large angel. So very clear. Absolutely, I knew he was going to be fine, absolutely in this angel's embrace. The thing is, though, with angels, I can see through them, but yet I see their form. If you hold up a glass of water, you can see the water, but you can see through it. It might be distorted. That's how I have seen angels. Angels, though, don't know I exist. I'm like persona non grata. I mean, it's like grata, whatever. Anyway, I don't count. I never elicited a response from an angel ever, except for once. And this is my favorite angel story. And this is what I'm feeling led to share with you. So I'm used to being ignored by angels, and I'm seeing angels everywhere because they're everywhere. They're here. We pack them. We enter this room, not with one, but maybe a bunch. Depends on what your needs are. I see angels at bedsides. I see angels in nature. I did. There was a little twist. That was a past tense. I still sense them strongly. When I was seeing them, it was like contained water, and they would always ignore me. But whoa, in hospitals, there were plenty. Okay, in the book, a man named Saul had been admitted, and it turned out his nephew was the resident in charge. That was dicey because Saul, his body wanted to die. But the resident kept saying, again, you know, with the zappers, again, again. And no one was comfortable saying, stop, he's gone. And it went on and on and on. And I was standing in the room going, oh, this is awful. And then I looked up, and as if I could see through all of the stories of this huge hospital, coming down like a wedge of flying geese were angels. And I knew they were coming for Saul. And down they came. And they got to his body and left with his spirit. And then it was a social worker who said to the resident, your uncle's gone. And he was. His uncle was gone. He was with the angels. But my favorite angel story is the one, of course, that gave me attention. And it's only happened once. But I call him the I-5 angel. We have rush hour. In Seattle, it's not that there was a lot of traffic then, it's just that there was only one way to get north and south. So that was I-5, and it got to be a very crowded experience, and sometimes there were traffic problems, go figure. Well, one of those times I'd left work, I was headed south, and all it was were just like lanes of red lights, brake lights. No one was going anywhere. But there was this guy, I'll try not to be judgmental, so I won't say Yahoo, but you know,
who thought if he honked and swore loud enough in his little two-seater sports car that all of the cars ahead of him were suddenly going to vanish. So it was honk, honk, and I was sitting there and I thought, enough. So I finally turned to give him the stink eye. And there, seated next to him, all hunched over, was this huge angel. Again, I could see through, but see the form. And the angels I had seen have been big, bigger than humans. And there he was, scrunched up. I swear, if he straightened up, his head would have stuck out from the top of the car. That would have been very strange, but he was scrunched down. Here's me. I'm still driving the green weenie, by the way, which made it ever more dangerous, because we're into stick shiftsville. Here's me. Because I've never seen an angel and not wanted to throw myself on the ground. It's just that the ground in that particular case was a freeway. But I was shocked. So I was, and here's the angel doing what angels have always done in my presence. Nothing. Looking straight ahead. Then, here's me. You can't see me, but I am aghast over here. And here's the angel looking straight ahead. I don't exist. Again, here's me. And then the angel turned really slowly, looked me right in the eye, and went, what can I do? He's my guy. I didn't ask for this. I am as frustrated and embarrassed for him as you are. And then he turned around. I never got any more attention. Not since that day either. Ridiculous. May I take some questions? I could stay here all day. You guys are really, I feel like I'm on some wonderful heavenly way station. Is there time for questions? I stopped seeing angels physically when I was about 5 months pregnant with my daughter, my first pregnancy. And it was a Christmas, and there's a big old angel on a piano at a Christmas musical presentation. And there was an angel. And then I felt the flutter in me that was the baby. And I turned to my friend and said, oh, the baby's here. And I turned back and I couldn't see the angel. But the angel was there. And I think it was just taken from me so that I was a better mom. Because I couldn't be a mom and spend my motherhood like, I mean, that just wasn't going to fly. I had to be a little more focused.
I've heard the story of the shoe on the roof before.
Ledge.
And I don't know whether you were here before and told it or somebody else told the story.
Other people tell it. It's a very famous story, but I have been here and told the story before.
Would you please repeat it a little slower?
No, will you buy the book? Okay, I'll read it aloud to you afterwards in the parking lot, okay? Bottom line is...
Tell me about the color you say...
Blue.
And what did they say, what the girl say it was? What color did she say it was?
Blue.
Blue?
But there's also a red tennis shoe that was found on a roof of a hospital in Connecticut in Hartford. So there is some confusion. But I'm the blue shoe on the ledge. By the way, that shoe, people have said to me, show me the shoe and then I'll believe. And I say, clean my garage and I'll show you the shoe. It's in there somewhere. We have a 900 square foot garage that could be featured on the show Hoarders. In fact, I wish they would come. I need help, and our garage needs help. The shoe was in there. That didn't answer your question, but thanks for asking. Call me. I just don't want to repeat it slower.
Could you tell us more about the math and the music?
Only in metaphor. And the metaphor happens to be from a movie that did it for me. The movie's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And when the mothership... in the movie comes down. By the way, in April 77, all kinds of things happened. That movie, which I'll expound, Maria and the Tennis Shoe. In April 77, Raymond Moody had a bestseller book out called Life After Life. And in April 77, a mom came up to a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and said, my son told me this amazing story, and he was dead, and now he's back. And pivotal month. But anyway, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mothership comes, communicating with humans through music. The humans in the movie are using keyboard. The mothership would give notes,
and the young scientist on the keyboard would imitate the notes. Then there were these big cables that went to computers that they were like trailers. They were so big then. They were white. The computer would change the music into math, and the math is what the scientists in the movie could read. That's how they knew to go to Devil's Tower in the first place. So the combination between the aliens and the scientists on Earth was through math and music. And I thought, oh my gosh, who is Steven Spielberg? Is he here? Anyway, I don't know how else to describe it, except that it was perfect communication. And maybe it was only for me. Maybe you'll hear French or English. Go figure. Would that be awesome? But the communication from God, it's not with a language that I heard, not a language on earth. But yet I understood it perfectly. And since then, when God shows up, which God shows up for all of us all the time, really, it's more like being downloaded with information now than any kind of math and music thing. Now that we have computers, it's like I have awarenesses. That awareness is just put upon me.
I'm wondering more, I'd like to know more about the negative energy. Is it always present? How much power do we have to withstand it or overcome it or resist it? And is it present in heaven if you experienced it there?
Okay, three questions. The first one was, do I still perceive it? Or what?
Is it like ever present?
Oh yeah.
And can we withstand it? Like, are we?
Okay, first let's get back to ever present. We're talking flies at a picnic. We have an ant invasion at our house right now. That's negative energy. They're like everywhere. How many ants are in a hive? Well, that's like negative energy. It is everywhere. We have 1,000% and beyond authority over it. You can knock it back whenever. I personally don't need a lot of Latin or a priest on hand. You know what I do to get, and I've become quite the little exorcist actually, but basically do you pay rent here? No. Get out. We have authority. It's scared of us. So, yeah. Now, but that little free will thing. Some people, don't get me started on gun control, but some people who have negative energy that they have included in their persona then get weapons and hurt people or even use their hands and hurt people. It's free will time, but we do have authority over it. Absolutely. And what was the last question? Oh, no. Nothing but love in heaven. Now, fear is the opposite of love. Negative energy works on fear. They're like terrorists. Scare one person, you scare a million. That's how negative energy works. No, everything was beyond love in heaven. None of that. No. Will you invite me back? Because I just feel like this time's really flying. And I love you. I really feel like ridiculously relaxed and silly. Sometimes I can be professional. This is not one of those times. I'm just enjoying myself. I did not drink. Afterwards, I will. Again, I'm Lutheran. There'll be a beer. There's going to be something. But
okay, so my question is, a lot of people have experiences with our Savior Jesus Christ, and your experience was with God, Heavenly Father. In your research of a couple thousand people plus, how many experience Christ and how many experience Heavenly Father? Is there usually a...
Good question. And actually, my next talk is in L.A., and it's called Jesus in the Afterlife. So come on down. Sadly, research-wise, there's no research. So I can only draw upon my clinical experience and answer it most purely that way, because there is no research on this. But of research that has been done on the light, it's about 10%, but it's small samples and would not fly in an academic setting, the research. There are people that encounter a light that they don't identify as Heavenly Father, but as Jesus. And then I gotta say, well, how do you know it's Jesus? Like name tag, hello, I'm your Lord and Savior, you know? But they know. They know it's Jesus because they know it's Jesus. I've done a lot of work with children, and my favorite stories are about Jesus and children. Jesus shows up with a lot of kids who almost died. Lots and lots of Jesus stories, and those are mainly the stories I tell. The adult population, though, the only figure I can give you is 10%. Now, 70-plus percent see deceased loved ones, and that's by far the majority of who they're greeted with when they die. Way, way the majority.
You use a lot of humor. Is there humor in, have you, did you experience any humor on the other side?
Yeah, God, it's a complete crack up. For me, yeah, it was, I'd like to think this is God-given humor. I think you're seeing it. I don't think God's very serious. I think God is absolutely delighted with most things and loves us and thinks we're a hoot. You know, I don't want to reduce God to a person that laughs, but yeah, I'd say jolly, happy, pleased with divine work. And I think that to laugh, if God had emotions, brings good feelings to God. I am blessed by it. My humor is a blessing. It's also the opposite of negative energy. I'm so fearless, it's ridiculous. But if you're looking at negative energy and you're laughing, it's like negative energy wants to shrink like a, oh my gosh, I'll tell you later what I thought of, my metaphor, but think of cold water. But anyway, yeah, it's, you know, it just happens. I'm sorry. I have not been drinking. I've never been this loose here, ever, right? Excuse me a moment, right?
I experienced a near-death experience a couple weeks ago.
Wow, are you raw?
And who did you go to when you started? I'm remembering bits and pieces of the experience now. Who did you go to when first go to talk to about this?
Okay, if it existed, I would go to this group. Welcome home. I didn't have a group, which is why I started one. I had a diagnosis that I put upon myself as crazy, but I wasn't crazy, and you're not crazy. It's a, you know, and it's a biological event. It's waiting for all of us. Anyone here not going to die? Think it's really not going to happen? Okay, there's the one. But he did have a drink before the meeting. So, yeah, what you experience is overwhelming, it's shattering, it's life-changing, it's going to take you. There's one researcher that says 7 years to work it out. And that's how long it took me. But this is your best venue. And these are the people that will walk you through it all. And so, may I introduce Bill English to, what is your name? Nikki? Nikki, Bill. Bill, Nikki, you are going to get together afterwards. And then it's two hugs, one for you for waiting, and then one for you for sharing. Such a personal thing. 2 weeks. Ay, ay, ay.
Hi, I'm a social worker, and I've had clients struggling with this and ask about it, and also some family members who are trying to deal with loved ones who have committed suicide. And I was wondering if there's any research on that or experiences.
Oh my, yes.
People wonder.
So in September in Washington, D.C., I'm giving a presentation on suicide and near-death experiencers. I have a business card. I have references, and I have a lot of information. I have three subspecialties in this subject: children, frightening, near-death experiences, and suicides. And I hit it hard in here. There's a whole section of here on suicides and some of the cases. By the way, may I say something on behalf of suicide? Don't do it. The old saying is it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. But as we all know, to get depressed, you know, if we're happy, you know, the world's our oyster. We're out here, you know, we love life. As we get depressed, our focus goes in until there's just a peephole, and it says the only way out is death. Do you think, after such a hard knock life, that one would want to kill oneself, that God's going to be on the other side to kick you to the curb? That is not going to happen. My apologies to any Catholic who wants to bury their own outside of the churchyard. That is not God. God loves all of us and has a special tender heart towards the pained, hurting masses, which make up most of humanity. So I've never, ever heard of
One woman in Seattle said that she saw hell, but she wasn't going there. It was just kind of like, oh, there, and phew. Yeah, so this, it's a mental health problem. Yes.
Hi, you said something about 7 years. Could you repeat that? And then also, yeah. Are you a water sign?
I am so ill-informed. I'm a Gemini.
That explains it. No, just kidding.
Oh, great. I have an explanation. No, I do know a little bit about it, but I think that's an air sign, Gemini. I don't know.
That's an air sign.
Again, Lutheran. They don't go to that. I mean, it's like ridiculous. The 7 years, PMH Atwater, Google her. She's the one who did the research that measured the 7 years, and I would say that's about right. Kids quicker. In fact, with children, oh my gosh, it's crazy. I interview kids not with words, but with crayons. And so, you know, they draw things, and then, you know, I want to get more and more out of them. And it's like, I might as well, it's like, yeah, saw God. Do you have any gum? It's like, you saw God, what?
Okay, well, just so you know that Geminis are known to be messengers.
Oh, that's why I'm such a big mouth. Geminis are supposed to be messengers. I am the messenger. I was sent back. I am the one of them. Yeah, I was sent back to calm people down about dying. Yes.
I have only a comment. What you said reminds me, the Bible says, perfect love casteth out fear.
Ooh, yeah.
And based on your experience, that is certainly true.
Yes, thank you. Yes, that's true. But that's true for everybody here. Everybody's got God. Everybody can have love. Everybody can do anything you want. We're like little miracles on 2 feet, some of us in heels. It's ours. Fear not would be the message I would give people. Because if you're afraid of something, replace it with love. I know that's simplistic, especially if your husband's beating you. But you know what I mean? Love will, it's like the cream. Love will rise to the top, I promise. And it will cast out fear. Don't know how it works. I just know it does.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what it felt like for you to go into the presence of God? It just seems like those of us, when I hear people speak of a near-death experience, they tell me about that love. But it seemed like for here on earth, we kind of say, who am I? Do I count?
Not any more than me or that person or any less than her. We all count.
How can we feel that love now? How can we feel it here on earth?
Well, what I do, but just one woman's advice is that I pray about it and I ask people to join me in prayer so that I can feel that love. But guess what? Be careful what you pray for, because to be in the presence of God isn't something to be taken lightly. I mean, I'm joking around and all that, but if I were in flesh, I would not have been able to experience that much love. But your dose is every bit as much as mine or anybody else here. And you're with people, I think, that can respond to you and give you that comfort. And that self-esteem, come on. You think God would make someone as perfect as you and then go, not so good, huh? I'll do better next time. That's just not how it works. And I don't care if you limp or if you're pockmarked or whether you believe that God loves you that much or not. It doesn't matter to God. You are that loved. You can't do anything but get God's love. There's not a bad guy that God hasn't loved. God made all of us. We were born innocent and perfect. And you're there. You're not a bad guy. So you'd have to ask yourself, why do you think, who taught you that you are less than anything that God would love with God's whole heart? And then get over it. Because whatever you're trying to believe is not true. It's simply not true. But there are people here, because you're just crying, that will love you. And through them, you will feel God's love.
Okay, I'll be here, and I'll sign books if you wish. And thank you, and God bless you all. Mwah.